Welcome to the Voices of the West, hosted by Emil Franzi and dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
Hi there. Welcome to Voices of the West. Glad to have as a guest for this hour one of my favorite local authors, Jane Eppinger. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Other than a twisted knee from my trip to China, I'm doing okay.
What were you doing over there, researching a new Western?
Yeah, right. No, actually, maybe we could do a program on this later. I was invited by the Pearl Buck Institute to present a paper in China. And I did.
Well, you know what? That was one of my dad's favorite authors. And somewhere in that vast library I keep moving around, there's probably about 10 Pearl Buck novels that, you know, probably not first editions, but stuff that was done in the 30s and the 40s when she was very popular.
Right. And she was the first woman to win both the Pulitzer and the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, let's take a sidebar for about a minute or two and tell them about who Pearl Buck really was. She was a fascinating author. Most of her stuff was about China.
Right. She was born in the United States but went to China with her missionary parents when she was about 3 months old. She wrote the book most everybody knows about, which is The Good Earth. We went to the symposium. They took a paper of mine that's going to be published later. We visited her home and her museum and attended the symposium. And then we visited where she went to school and taught school in the Choksi School and another village. And then we went to Nanjing, where she also lived. Nanjing was also where they had the what they call the Rape of Nanjing.
Oh, yeah, terrible. I cited that as a good reason to drop nukes to end World War II, because everybody forgets something, and I'm going to make this plug for my old friend Harry Truman. Everybody forgets the small detail that the Japanese had oppressed most of the Far East and treated most of the people there as Nanking, as Nanking, Nanjing, or whatever. When you go through all of China and the genocide that was committed against those people was far greater than anything was ever done in the Japanese, and they lost more people in China alone in about 2 months to that rape than were killed in Nagasaki and Hiroshima put together. So you had to end the war to keep not just American POWs from dying en masse, but all those people in Asia who'd been conquered by a very brutal regime.
Right. You're so there. And also they have a very peculiar, very odd museum. Like the Holocaust, they just dumped the people into these pits. And what they did at the museum is they did a cross-section through the pit so that you can see several feet of people who died. It's something I couldn't even take a picture of. And after they left Nanjing, they lived for a while. The Bucks lived for a while in Japan, actually. And then they came back to the United States. And then Pearl became started her writing career in the United States. And her welcome wagon, where she put up children who were of mixed blood. And anyhow, that was my trip to China, and that is to be continued.
Okay. We've got your website up here in the studio, and I'm looking at what's in print right now. There's a whole lot. I'm up to number 7. We got a lot of books to talk about, ma'am. By the way, I was going to point something out. You're an exception to this rule. But somebody said something to me about a couple of writers down in Sonoyta, and I said, you know what? There are 247 published authors currently living in the state of Arizona, and 159 of them live in Sonoyta.
What? Really?
No, but see, I got you on that one. There are all kinds of authors down there I keep tripping over. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike Blake, the late Mike Blake, who just died a little bit ago, was living down there, down the road from my good friend Terry Mort, who wrote a great book called Wrath of Cochise, among others, about that particular neck of the woods and the Western heritage. He's written some other stuff, too. And while I'm doing this, I'm taking notes again on various book titles that you still have that are in print from your website. Let's give me your website real quick, too, while we're at it.
It's the three W's, www.desert-silhouette, with a plural, .com.
All right. And I don't really know where to begin, so I suppose we could just begin with one that was on top, and that's Unsolved Arizona.
Right. Well, can I begin?
You can begin wherever you want.
Okay. My newest book on Henry Ossian Flipper, you should be getting a copy pretty quick.
Oh, okay. I thought that one, is that a reprint? Because I thought you did that one already.
I did it, but it's not a reprint. It's a really new book.
Oh, okay.
And it's done by Wild Horse Media in Fort Worth, Texas, and I just sent them your name this morning because I just got the book yesterday because I had a whole bunch of new information.
Oh, okay.
And I thought maybe that might be good for the February for the Black History Month. I'm very pleased with the book. What was interesting was when we talked about redoing it, the guy said to me, send me your copy on disc. And I looked and I looked and I could not find it. It was the last thing I did on the typewriter. Redid the whole thing, all the new stuff. And I got a bunch of new stuff to put into, and a bunch of new pictures, including Flipper when he was 14 years old, his mother and father. I just got a whole bunch more stuff.
Hey, let's tell him who he was.
Henry Ossian Flipper was West Point's first black graduate. And he lived several years in Nogales, and he spent a lot of time in Tucson. He was born in Thomasville, Georgia, and he died in... He died in Atlanta, and finally, President Bill Clinton, the president gave him a pardon.
Well, what did he have to get pardoned for? How'd that happen?
Well, that's kind of strange, because you don't get a pardon unless you say you're guilty, and he always said he was not guilty, but these two young lawyers... in Washington, they wanted Flipper pardoned, and President Clinton signed a pardon for him. And so, you know, Corey, now he is belatedly not guilty.
All right, well, what happened? He got to West Point. What class was he at West Point?
1878.
Class of 1878. A little hard on him. Even getting there, who appointed him?
It was a man by the name of, it was one of the, his name was Freeman, and he was one of Flipper's congressmen.
At that time, the South, that would have been after 1876, was Freeman himself black, or was he?
No, he was white.
He was a white guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he made the first black appointment to West Point, or at least the first one finished.
Not the first appointment. Flipper was the first graduate. There were five others, but they didn't make it through.
Well, and I'm sure a lot of people made sure that they didn't.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean that's the part you got to address right here, and I'm sure you do in the book. And because I read the first one, about how tough it really was on this gentleman to make it through this, and there had to be, and I think you found a few where you actually had some of the guys were kind of on his side.
Oh yes, yes.
A lot of them were.
Yeah. In fact, their attitudes toward him changed, you know, once they all graduated and didn't have to worry about graduation, then their attitudes toward Flipper changed, then other things happened.
Well, you know what's interesting about that? You know what it reminds me of? It's exactly the same experience that occurred many years later with Jackie Robinson.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the baseball players of that era, one of whom happened to be my brother, had a different attitude, and a lot of them were just flat-out racist, throwing bean balls and trying to spike him and doing everything else. And you had a bunch of other guys who were kind of cheering him on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the thing that turned it. Mm-hmm. And Flipper did not turn West Point because one was the next graduate after him.
It was a man by the name of Davis, and it was almost 50 years later.
Yeah, I mean, he was the... unlike Robinson, he didn't break the ice that strongly for anybody else, unfortunately.
No,
I got to go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I was going to grab a break, and I'm going to come back to the rest of the list.
Okay.
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
And in honor of Columbus Day, an Italian-American holiday, we played a little music from For a Few Dollars More, Good Spaghetti Western, with a film score by Ennio Morricone.
All right.
How about that? Jane Eppige, we're talking about Henry Flipper, Henry Ossian Flipper, the first West Point Black graduate. Tell us what happened to him after he went into service, because he got court-martialed.
Well, he got court-martialed. He got kicked out of the military. He worked for a while in Mexico for the Mexican government on land grants. And then he came in and he worked in the United States in Tucson on land grants. Very highly thought of. Then he went to Venezuela, worked for the oil company. He worked for Colonel Green down in Sonora. And then he eventually went back to Georgia, and he died. He was born on the eve of the Civil War, and he died on the eve of World War II.
Okay, so he lived into the 30s, early 40s.
Early 40s. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's pretty long life. So, what did the president have to pardon him for?
He was found guilty, not of stealing money, but of conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman.
In other words, he was tried for being black.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We basically got that. They bagged him. It would be a little like Jackie Robinson not quite making it. There was no Branch Rickey.
No, no branch, Ricky.
All right. I'm going to move on because we've got a whole bunch of other books we need to talk about. Pick the one you want.
Arizona Unsolved.
I think that's a fun book.
It's wonderful.
A history of murder, mayhem, and mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of it here.
There certainly is a lot of it. There's a lot more. I'd like to do another book on the ones that I have left over. And it's not always people, but often it is. And I wish that Ambrose Bierce, who disappeared somewhere near the border, had disappeared in Arizona. I would have loved to have
you. Yeah, that would have been fun. Well, maybe he did. You know, he just disappeared. He could have kept disappearing from somewhere else.
But I don't know. I don't know. The ones that I do know did disappear in Arizona.
Who's and about? All right, people who disappeared in Arizona. Give us one of the more interesting ones.
Paul Fugit.
Okay.
In Chiricahua Mountains. I mean, Chiricahua National Monument.
That's recent, I mean, in the scheme of things.
Yes, it is. And, you know, he and his wife parted after they had lunch, and that was the last she ever saw of him.
Now, where exactly was this in Chiricahua?
The monument.
Okay.
But where exactly, I don't know. And then, of course, there's the Sally Klump. The Klump family has quite a reputation, hardworking but clannish. And one day, Sally just disappeared.
And nobody ever known what happened.
What happened to her?
Well, how about old Adolf up at the Dutchman?
Oh, okay. I think you probably have it there with that picture with that hole in his head.
Go ahead and tell that one. That's a good story.
Well, Adolf Ruth was an elderly man in his 70s, and he, like so many, he had the Dutchman's gold lure, and he was living in Washington. he got himself car, and a young man drove him to the Apache Junction, and Tex Barkley on the ranch didn't want to take him. He was too elderly, the weather was too hot, and he was afraid of letting him go in alone, and he told Adolf Ruth, wait until he got back, but Ruth would not wait. He got two cowboys to take him into the, pack him in.
When was this, by the way?
Look at the date there. I can't, it just left me right now.
About early 20th century?
Oh, later than that. Adolf was in the 1930s.
Okay.
Anyhow, he got packed in and disappeared. And Tex Barkley, the rancher, was furious. They went and looked for him. They could not find him. And then it was a few months after he disappeared, they were in looking for traces of Indian relics. And the dog, Music, who's on the front cover, found that skull, but no skeleton. And so it had a hole on each side, and they sent it to the Smithsonian, and the Smithsonian found out that it was from dental records that it was Adolf Ruth. And that there was no denying that, but there was arguments whether it was a gunshot or whether some people said it was a coyote that took a chunk out of him. Personally, I think he was shot and killed. but I don't know who did it.
Or why.
And then...
I mean, why would anybody... What would the motive have been?
Okay. Adolph Ruth had a map.
Ah.
Some topo maps, which could have been... they could have been maps that showed where there was gold. Maybe, maybe not. But then what happened, after a few months after they found the skeleton, they found Adolph Ruth's skeleton. After they found his...
skull.
Oh, they found the skeleton. And...
Now, how would his skull get that far away? I mean, it's hard to believe that...
3/4 of a mile away from the... From the skeleton.
I wouldn't think a coyote or another predator would have bothered to carry it quite that far.
I wouldn't either. I don't know why. I think he was murdered. I don't know who did it. They later found that the two men that packed him in were driving around in his car.
Uh-huh. That's a maybe.
They brought him. There were some accusations and lawsuits. They said they did not. Steal anything from Adolph Ruth, and they did not do anything to harm him. So we don't know.
Hmm.
There are still relatives of two men. Living in Texas.
So how many folks wandered in to the Superstitions looking for that famous supposed
gold? Probably 100.
Yeah. How many of them never came back? More than one.
Oh, less. And the other one that is in conjunction that disappeared was Walter Gassler. And... that was in the 1930s as well. I'm talking off the top of my head right now. But Walter is the 80s, and two men found him sitting near a saguaro, and they called the sheriffs. Both the Pinal and the Maricopa County Sheriff's jurisdiction, Apache Jam. Superstition Mountains,
mm-hmm.
And they brought him back, and they decided that that he had not been done any harm. It was just old age, heat, exhaustion, and his son, a man by the name of Roland Gassler, said that he was his son. He came up and he said he wanted Walter's personal effects. And Jim Collenborn gave them to him. There was no reason to keep it. Then supposedly there was a map. But anyway, some months later, Tom was giving a talk at Apache Junction on the case. And a man came up and said he was Roland Gassler and would like to have his effects. It was not the same person. So Tom had him checked out, and sure enough, he was the real Roland Gassler.
Hmm.
But who was the other man, and what happened to him?
Hmm.
And that's one of the many stories of Apache Junction.
Fun book and also Unsolved Arizona Mysteries. All right, hang on, Jane. We're going to take another break, and we're going to come back, and we'll maybe talk about the Buck on Tombstone.
Oh,
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
I don't know if the good, the bad, and the ugly exactly fits Columbus Day, you know? What do you think?
It's an Italian Western.
I can get away with that being Italian. Okay, I'll tell you a book of yours I found really fascinating. Southern Arizona Cemeteries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, tell about that one.
Can I ask you... Emil, did you also get my book on Tucson?
Yes.
The one that's in full color.
Yeah, that's a great book, too. I mean, I don't know where to begin with some of this stuff. I can go all the way back to Arizona Sheriffs.
Well, we might be redoing that, too.
Well, there's been some new ones come along since then. A couple I'm probably, you know, I mean, you could celebrate Dupnik finally retiring. Because I think he may have lasted about as long as anybody ever did.
Who?
Dupnik. Clarence was sheriff for 35 years?
I guess he is the longest one now.
He was, yeah, now that he's gone. I mean, he cut it off at 35, but I'm trying to think back on who really served that much time as a sheriff anywhere, and no one got anywhere near close. Arpaio's done pretty close. I think he's been there for about 20.
Yes.
And some of these guys go on for a while, and I suspect somewhere we may be overlooking something, but it's kind of hard to do. But at any rate, back to the cemetery book, and then we'll go to the Tucson book, and then we'll do the sheriff book, and then we'll be out of time. Go for the cemeteries, because I think that one was, really do think that was absolutely fascinating.
Well, that was fun to do, too. And it's interesting. What graves tell us, people?
Oh yeah, you know, I got into that at one point when I was back in Illinois for consulting work, and I happened to go to a church with a friend, and this church had been, God, I was in suburban Chicago, not Chicago itself, but one of the Burr Ridge or one of the suburbs, and there was a graveyard there that had stuff back to about 1800. And I mean, not 1800 something, I mean 1800. And I went through and wrote down some tombstones. It was just absolutely fascinating to see people that, you know, were born in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some of that around here. I suspect there's some folks on some of these graveyards that were born before 1800.
Oh, I'm sure there are. Especially out in the country. You know, I was also fascinated, you know, like with the Holy Hope and with Evergreen. You know, there's thousands of people buried there.
Yes, and some of those graves go back a long way.
Yeah, and the one thing I wanted to point out with the, like, you know, we have those wonderful trees in Evergreen. And they are drought resistant, and they came from Aleppo.
They're not all that's coming from Aleppo now.
No, it's different now, but
kind of had to do that. Forgive me, but no, those are that's a good point. Those are fascinating trees.
Yeah, and then of course Holy Hope is the. Right next door, and it's Holy Hope has the graves of the five of the seven sisters of Carondelet that came to Tucson. And it has also five of the original priests that came to Tucson, Sal Point, and men like him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these are names you say, oh, wait a minute, that's how we got that called that. There, yeah. That's him, and that's why.
Yes, and, well, and there's a lot of the early pioneer families are there too, by the way, as you know.
Families, yes.
But you, you didn't just do Tucson, and you just didn't do the big ones. You found some small stuff out there that's very fascinating. Some of it was private.
I did the border, but I did everything that is available for people to go look at. I didn't want to put in anything that people couldn't go see.
No, some of it is, there are still family plots in the back of ranch houses, really. And all through parts of Arizona. And and many of them are just, there's just exactly that. They're private and none of your damn business.
Right. And people would tell me, you can look at them, but don't put them in the book. Well, you know, okay. I did and I did. I did and I did not. Johnny Ringo is one of the more famous ones. It's on the Sander Ranch.
Yes. And that family is still the same family that I believe, unless something's happened recently, that owned that ranch when Ringo's body was found.
And they let you go. They let you go in it. They ask that you give permission, but they do let you go in it, and they let you see the grave. But he's one of the more famous outlaw graves. The other thing that is famous, of course, you got to put in Boot Hill.
Oh, wait a minute. You got to include Ringo in their Unsolved Arizona Mysteries because we still haven't figured out who shot him.
Who shot him? Yeah. But there is a second tombstone grave, a cemetery.
Uh-huh. Yes, there is. I've been there.
Yeah, it has some interesting graves and people.
Because they had
go ahead.
No, it predates the one that's out there that everybody goes to.
Does it? I wasn't sure.
I think it does.
It has some recent graves in it. It doesn't. The thing about the Boot Hill, number one, it is a real cemetery.
Yes. Some people think it's just something fake that was put up for Teresa's. No, that's a real cemetery.
But those funny sayings that they have on them, those were put on much later. Four shots from a .44.
Yeah.
More. And Les Moore is a real person. I'll give you a quick story on him.
Yeah, go. Because that's a famous tombstone.
Yeah, He was a NACO Wells Fargo agent, and this guy came up and wanted his package, and the package was damaged, and both men drew guns over the Wells Fargo package, and they both were killed. But Les Moore, four shots from a .44, no less, no more. But that sound didn't get put up too much later. I will tell you what I think is a fake there, and that is that, quote, Jewish memorial.
Oh.
I do not believe that is real. There's no evidence that anybody is buried there. There were some people that said that they were supposed to fly and do ultraviolet or ultra-red photography and find the graves, but no graves have been found. But it's a lovely memorial. But who's buried there? Nobody.
Well, that's a variation on print the legend. In this case, we print the tombstone. Okay. Southern Arizona cemeteries. We can just bridge that into the book on tombstone. Tell us about things about Tombstone we might not know that the most of the people. Tombstone is kind of like going to Disneyland, only the people who work the exhibits live in them year round.
Yes, it is. The graves, they're real graves, but the sign, but it's the signs, and people love the signs that are there. But also, you know, if people have time, they should stop and see this second cemetery.
Now that's is we got this correct. That's the one that's over there by that little sort of redo of a western town that the Germans tried to put in that sort of fell on its fanny. If you know the one I'm talking about, if you take that side road out of Tombstone, I wish I could remember which direction.
Yeah, you take the side. Yeah,
and the other graveyard's over there.
Right, the
Boot
Hill one.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I tell you what, we got to take another break. When we come back, let's talk about another book of yours, Arizona Goes to War.
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
Here's a famous historical question that could only be asked on Voices of the West going into Columbus Day. When was the first pizza baked in Arizona? I think that is a major piece the way you ought to go find out. Yeah, it's a shame he's no longer with us. He's one of my best friends, John T. Hamilton. And he had the world's greatest collection, because he was on the cover of Arizona Highways a few years ago, of Arizona tokens. The business took territorial tokens, the things that used to be, you know, a nickel off on your beer or whatever. And he actually wrote the book on them, and there was all kinds of neat stuff in there that you didn't know was being done in Arizona back in the 1870s and 1880s when those tokens were very common. And I think many of them extended into the 20th century. But by and large, that the highlight of that era would have been the 1880s and the 1890s. I don't know whatever happened to his collection, because he moved off to Florida and died about 3 or 4 years ago. He's a good friend of mine. Great guy. I went to school with him. And that was an interesting subject. You've probably tripped over those, as we all have, when we poke through this stuff.
Yeah, I have, but haven't done much with them.
No, and it turns out a bunch of them, hey, they're collectibles. There's people pay a lot of money for them.
Yeah.
Because I remember he had some of those things he could get $50 or $100 for.
Oh, yeah. And I wanted to ask you also, were you familiar with the story of James Kidd?
James Kidd, refresh me.
He's in your Unsolved Mystery.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
He just flat out disappeared. He lived in a $4 a month hovel, smoked a nickel a day cigar, stole a newspaper. And he was going to go work on his prospect, worked at San Paul. I have one picture of him in there. He worked, well, when they started going through his stuff, he had no family, but he ended up with almost of a quarter of $1 million in stocks and bonds. And he left a will that said that after they paid $100 for his service, he would like the rest of his money to go to a fund to prove that it could be proven that there is a picture of the soul leaving the body at the time of death. Well, you can imagine what that brought out, the needy and the greedy, hurry, when people heard about that. And eventually, there were about 150 people who applied to go to court to prove that they could prove the existence of a soul. It was Judge Myers down in Phoenix. And the funny part was, even the University of Arizona got in line to prove it, which I think is hilarious.
Not unusual. Excuse me. I have seen them go on bigger chases for nothing than that.
Well, it just cracked me up. Both ASU, and I believe eventually NAU and the U of A applied to try and get the money. As it turned out, what the judge, he made the ruling that the money would go to the Barrow Institute in Phoenix because they were doing research on the neurons of a cat, and thought that was the end of it. But anyhow, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled no. You had to give it to money to someone who was actually doing paranormal research. And the attorney that helped me on it was Melvin Belli.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
And he didn't tell me. It was one of his clients, but he told me how to go about finding out what I wanted to know. So anyhow, the judge gave it to the Duke Parapsychological Institute and Duke University, and they actually do sincere research on the existence of a soul, and they were quite nice to me. They gave me papers and material and on what they had done on it. But the whole thing is, whatever happened to James Kidd?
Yeah. How about that? Well, not like that, but at that time, that $250,000 was a whole lot more than it is now.
Well, yeah, it was a lot of money. And he lived like he was in absolute poverty. And they had all these people that came from all over the world. You know, some were real crackpots, but I thought it was funny. Since when does the University of Arizona prove that it can prove the existence of a soul? I just thought that was hilarious.
I'm going to jump. I got about 4 minutes. I wanted to jump to Arizona and the war and World War II. And what we had here, and you know what it really reminded me of when we were talking about this was when I was in the Air National Guard back in the 60s, and we had a little party for the Lufthansa folks, and all these krauts came in, and it turned out that many of them had been here before, who were working for Lufthansa. Now, 20 years later, these guys are saying, oh, yeah, I must fit the Africa Corps captured in 43. And we had some POW camps here with a lot of people in them.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the fact that we also had some Japanese Americans, I believe, that were rounded up back in 42 at the beginning of the war.
Japanese Americans were kept at the Triangle P Ranch, and they were eventually exchanged for. Now, what I've got coming up, Emma, is a book that I am going to do on the German prisoners of war. And I've got it outlined and sketched out and got to get it done. But anyhow, what happened with those people, with Werner Drexler, there was one of them, maybe more, who were traitors to the Germans. And when their compatriots found out that they were traitors, they killed Werner Drexler.
Hmm.
They hanged him, but then what happened is the Americans charged the Germans who killed Werner Drexler with murder. My question is it murder or is it war or is there a difference?
Good question. I would say that had a bunch of Americans, I think I saw this movie, it was Stalag 17, where they actually did find out that the one American was a turncoat or a German spy either way. So they just sort of casually made sure he was in the wrong place at the wrong time outside at night, and the German camp guard shot him, remember? Was that murder, or was that patriotic duty? I don't know. I think it was probably the latter, but we can go from there. We got about 2 minutes. There was only one more. You had that fabulous escape, the famous one, of the German U-boat guys, and the two of them that had the boat and everything else, and they were headed for the... was it the Salt River they were going for? Because they didn't realize that that blue line on the map was not a real river until they got there.
Gila River.
It was the Gila. Okay. And and they eventually arrested that German U-boat captain in the lobby of a hotel, if I remember correctly.
Yes. Yes. And he died a couple years ago.
Yeah. I mean, he went, well... That was a pretty interesting bunch, and the German prisoners were treated reasonably decently by us, and many of our prisoners were treated okay by most Germans unless they happened to run into the SS or a few other little things along the way. So that war was a little more civilized than some of the others we fought, even considering the players. We got a minute. Tell me about one more book you want to push that we haven't mentioned.
The Tucson book that is in color.
Oh, it's, yes. Do that again.
Yeah, it's the past 50 years of Tucson, past 50 years of history. It's in full color, and it kind of fills in where
that's a beautiful book. Thank you for bringing it up, by the way.
They're just starting doing color, and I think it's beautiful, and invite your readers to have a look at it.
Take a look at it, and you... are you in any local bookstores? I got 20 seconds.
I'm in all of them right now. And on the 16th, on Helderado Days, that's coming up in Tombstone, I will be signing all those books down in Tombstone.
All right. Good time to go to Tombstone if you haven't been there for a while. That's worth the trip. Thank you, Jane Eppinger.
No.
Good having you. Go buy your stuff.
Thanks for listening to Voices of the West.